I'm in San Francisco, California, on one of the city's famous cable cars heading down towards Union Square. Since 1849, when huge amounts of gold were discovered in the hills to the north of here, people have been coming to this spectacular city to make their fortunes and the world a better place. This is where feminism and gay rights really got going, where hippies set up communes to create a new utopia, and where singers like Scott McKenzie preached a message of goodwill to everyone. If you're going to San Francisco. But now, San Francisco is home to a different kind of gold rush. Just an hour's drive south of here is Silicon Valley, home to some of the most successful companies on Earth. The area has more millionaires than pretty much anywhere else on the planet. And like the hippies, these high-tech pioneers also want to make the world a better place. But what is their vision for the world? I'm David Baker, and along with producer Peter Snowden, as part of the World Services Global Identity season, I'm investigating how Silicon Valley's values could be changing all our lives. Welcome to Default World. Silicon Valley is an extraordinary place, a global powerhouse that has given birth to a new industrial revolution. The people who work there are hugely entrepreneurial. They have an unbridled faith in the power of technology to solve the problems we face today. And they have an almost utopian mission to make the world a better place. And although they might not put it this way, to make us more like them. So where do these values come from? To find out, I drove an hour south of San Francisco to a place that has become the spawning ground of Silicon Valley's identity. This is Y Combinator, the Harvard of Silicon Valley. And this is the place where thousands of startups from around the world apply every year for a place on their three-month incubator program. And only a fraction of them get in. About 100 companies every year are successful. And we're here to see Kasai Yunis, who's the chief operating officer of Y Combinator. And we're going to try and find out from him what makes a Silicon Valley startup a success. Hi, Kasai, David Baker from the
Kasai,
BBC.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Hi there.
Welcome to YC.
Thanks very much indeed.
So you want to take a little tour?
I was just in Jamaica for a conference. And, you know, you look over the cab driver's shoulder and, you know, he's using Google Maps. I work on Google Maps. And then he switches to WhatsApp. And I know the WhatsApp team. You know, and it's amazing. You're like a quarter way around the world. And the first thing that you see is the things that people that you know worked on. I think 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the shadow of the valley was among, hobbyists is too small of a word, but among an early adopter tech crowd. And today, the shadow is over the entire globe. You know, even for the Pakistani villager who's using a phone, that's an Android operating device that's being done here in Mountain View. And so I think the valley is trying to figure out, okay, so if we are part of this, you know, truly global community, how are we good actors? The reason I'm very optimistic, I think the people here are very genuinely interested in doing the right thing. A lot of the founders are technical and they're engineers, and I think that Wall Street-esque, the dollar, you know, at all costs, I don't think that's a part of our culture. Mark Zuckerberg said he's donating 99% of his wealth. You know, you don't often see that in the hedge fund world. Or, I mean, maybe you do, and it's maybe not as public, but certainly that's common in the Valley. And this is part of the California culture. It's part of the hippie culture, the kind of very liberal West Coast culture that exists all the way from Amazon in Seattle all the way down here, where there is a view that, hey, you know, we're part of society, and there are larger implications.
That shadow that Kasai Yunis says Silicon Valley now casts across the globe is making the world a better place in a very particular way. It emphasizes business over regulation, individuals over states, and the power of technology above everything else. So where does this vision come from? Louis Rossetto, the founder of Wired magazine, has been chronicling the digital revolution since it began in the early 1990s. He says the Valley's utopian dreams began when the internet offered a new beginning for a world that was steeped in pessimism.
The 1980s were at the end of the Cold War, and it was a moment of extreme turmoil. People would proclaim that they didn't want to have babies because they didn't want to bring children into this horrible world. So to come across these people who were enthusiastic about the future that they were going to build was exciting, inspirational.
One thing about those early magazines was they always sort of kicked off with like a slogan or a call to action. I know we've got a book of these here. This is a rather flashy coffee table version of what we saw in those 90s. Maybe you could take us through. I mean, what was Wired preaching to the world?
Every issue started with a pulled quote, and the quotes themselves were supposed to be portentous enough that they could be inscribed, chiseled on the front of a building, so something pithy.
Can you show us some of these?
So we put the first 3 years of those opening spreads into a book that we called Mind Grenades, mm-hmm. Manifestos mm-hmm. from the Future.
And it's here. It's a pretty Technicolor Dayglow book. It's a rather nice coffee book. It's sort of pink and purple and vivid, vivid green.
The first spreads that we did was based on a quote from Marshall McLuhan.
So this is the very first spread of the very first Wired.
So the first thing that you read in the first Wired was this quote from Marshall McLuhan. Mm-hmm. And the quote is, "The medium or process of our time, electric technology, is reshaping and restructuring patterns of social interdependence and every aspect of our personal life. It is forcing us to reconsider and reevaluate practically everything. Everything is changing. Every thought, every action, and every institution formerly taken for granted."
That's not the pithiest revolutionary slogan in the world, is it?
This is the longest one we did. But the point is, everything is changing.
Everything is changing.
Everything is changing. Mm-hmm. Your
family, education,
your neighborhood, your government.
Yeah. They're changing.
Your changing. Job, yeah. Your relationship to the other.
Mm-hmm. And what was behind all that change was this amazing new tool, the internet.
People think about the revolution as being about computers, but the real revolution was about networks. Networks get more valuable with more participants. And the participation isn't linear. The value isn't linear. It's logarithmic. And when you get into the millions or the billions as it stands now, you start having rich level of interaction, of exchange of thoughts, of wisdom, of knowledge, providing, not to be too science fiction, but a sort of level of consciousness that the planet had never seen before.
So, for Rossetto, that ambition to change the world was almost limitless, to create nothing less than a new level of consciousness. Everything could be made better by people brought together by the power of technology. And the company that probably best represents that dream today is, no, not Google, but Facebook. We're used to thinking of Facebook as a way of keeping up with friends or sharing videos of amusing cats. But the company has bigger dreams than that, much bigger dreams. And the place those dreams, and maybe ours, are being forged is in Facebook's impressively cool new headquarters building, just off the highway, in California's Menlo Park. So this is it. We're at the heart of one of Silicon Valley's most successful companies, Facebook. This is a company that's ingrained in people's consciousness. It's one of the most famous brands in the world. They even made a film about its creation. And from here, Facebook can extend its influence to 1.5 billion people across the planet. That's a fifth of the world's population. We're going to meet Mike Schrepfer, Facebook's chief technology officer, and we're going to find out what's in store for this huge company.
Our mission is to make the world more open and connected. You're sitting with me here in one of the world's largest single-story, single-room buildings. You know, there's almost 3,000 people on one floor, you know, literally one office space. And this is, I think, the best physical manifestation I can think of our company culture. What we've done is we've kind of set out a 10-year plan, a 10-year technical vision, to talk about three real pillars on this. The first is connecting the world, not just on Facebook, but just in general to the internet. You know, there are billions of people around the world who have no access to any form of data network. We're working with Spacecom and Eutelsat next year to launch their satellite and help sponsor internet access for large sections of sub-Saharan Africa. We're developing new native technologies. One of them is a high-altitude, long-endurance aircraft. So it is an aircraft that has got the wingspan of a 737, but weighs about 800 to 900 pounds, so less than a car. And it's designed to, you know, fly over a region and provide internet access. The second is solving some of the hard problems in artificial intelligence research to help build systems that help people manage the onslaught of data you have every day. And the third is really to build new, amazing, interactive experiences using virtual reality. And you think about the richness of the experience you can have as we're having together in person here and how that falls apart when you're separated by a distance, right? And the best we have is a phone call or a video conference. And I think in the long run, the real vision for virtual reality is it allows you to have a really amazing, engaging social experience with someone else, even if you're hundreds or thousands of miles away.
Wait. These are pretty strong ambitions. To connect everyone on the planet, eliminate distance. And they don't even stop there. Facebook is on a mission to make blind people see. I went to see Matt King, a Facebook engineer who himself is blind, and he's working on a program that will unlock a huge part of the internet that right now is closed off to people with visual impairments, the 1.8 billion images we upload to the web every day.
What we have is a demo of what we're doing to help make photos more easily understood by people who use a screen reader who cannot see the photo at all. The basic idea here is that on Facebook, a lot of what happens is extremely visual. And as somebody who's blind, you can really feel like you're left out of the conversation, like you're on the outside. So we want to make people feel included. And artificial intelligence has advanced to the point where it's truly practical for us to try to get computers to describe the pictures in a meaningful way.
Okay, so this is your feed, is that right?
Yeah, this is content from my feed. And it's loaded into this prototype of our artificial intelligence system that does automated photo captioning.
Okay.
It's like, so here we have this example of my friend Shoshana has updated her profile picture. And typically when people update their profile picture, they don't write anything at all, right? And they could mm-hmm. put anything, you know. Mm-hmm. She could have put a picture of her cat mm-hmm. or a cat sitting on a bike or, you know, it could be potentially her.
Right.
So if I read through this with the screen reader, so I'll press the arrow. Let me see where I am in the feed.
Heading level 5, 2 items. Link. Shoshana Mueller updated her profile picture. Link. Image. This image may contain : one person smiling.
It's read the image and said there's one person and they're smiling.
Exactly.
Wow.
All right.
Wow.
And if you go, like, here's another example.
Heading level 5. Link. Vice President Joe Biden has made a surprise appearance this morning at the ANOC General Assembly in Washington, D.C. The Vice President joked that he will be the captain of the U.S. Olympic team.
And so there's quite a lot of writing here,
mm-hmm.
but there isn't any description of the picture, right? But if I move to the image, then we will hear what the AI system has told the screen reader to say.
This image may contain four people smiling indoor.
And indeed, there's Joe Biden, there's four people. Yep, they're indoor, they're smiling.
What am I naturally wanting to know, which you can see just by looking at the screen? You can see who's in the picture. And especially if it's photos of your friends,
mm-hmm.
you are going to be able to recognize who they are.
Sure.
So, of course, I would love to have that exact same information. In fact, I feel like I have a right to that information because you can see who's in the photos in your feed. I would really love to be able to have the system tell me who is in the pictures in my feed. And that, to me, is the next step, is to put the facial recognition into the system.
But that's meeting a little bit of resistance, you feel?
There are some people that are concerned about facial recognition and how it could be used. In this particular case, of course, I'm asking for information that's already available to other people to be revealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
So in this particular case, with this way of using it, I see it as a matter of fairness to people who are blind.
Fairness is a word you don't hear often in Silicon Valley, perhaps because the job of balancing one person's rights over another's is usually left to government. And in Silicon Valley, government is not a pretty word.
I think it is only a small exaggeration to say the government is so fundamentally evil that to deny the evil nature of the government is equal to denying the existence of the devil.
And, that's the voice of Peter Thiel, one of Silicon Valley's billionaire entrepreneurs. He was a co-founder of PayPal and an early investor in Facebook. And he's a man known for his feisty views on government. For many people here, the state in all its forms just gets in the way. And in this land of experiment, Thiel has started a very big experiment indeed, to see if it would be possible to bypass existing states entirely and embark on a new type of government, on floating artificial islands built out in the ocean in international waters.
We need a new space, a place for political experimentation. The next frontier is the ocean. With a little technical innovation to make this frontier accessible, we can unleash enormous political innovation. Let's let a thousand nations bloom on the high seas and build a startup sector for government.
This all sounds pretty fantastical, but it's a logical extension of Silicon Valley's values of pioneering independence and belief in technology. And the Valley has the money and the expertise to make it a reality.
So we see a world in several decades from now where there's thousands of floating cities, each with their own society, their own style, their own form of government, competing to attract citizens.
Randy Henken is director of communications at the Seasteading Institute, which was set up by Peter Thiel and others to develop those floating islands. We met him over a latte at a very land-bound roadside Starbucks.
In a world where our homes float, we can easily shift between city-states. And there's a marketplace of governments, and those that do the best thrive, and those that are not serving their citizens well will naturally depart. I think that it's crazy that here in California, so many decisions are made all the way across the continent in Washington, D.C. And I think that all of us would prefer to be able to make more choice in how our governments run. And the more localized our decisions, the better.
So how will these states away from states actually work?
We put together a plan with a team from the Netherlands that consists of using concrete barges with three-story buildings on them that could each host about 20 to 30 people. These barges would be shaped in squares or pentagons with 50-meter sides. And then they would be interchangeable, and you could put them together like a jigsaw puzzle and rearrange them to see how they fit and be able to move them from one nation to the next. It's not that government is evil. It's that rules matter. And government is a really big, hard problem to fix, especially the older it gets and the bigger it gets. And we would like to see a marketplace of government where the choice comes back down to groups of individuals who can say, I want to be a part of this or I want to opt out of this.
And in a way, this is already happening. Silicon Valley may not have its floating islands yet, but already the companies there are finding ways of insulating their workers from the everyday stresses and strains of living in a city. They're now laying on sleek, black-tinted shuttle buses that ferry their staff to and from work.
So now it's almost 8 o'clock, and there's probably 2-3 dozen people waiting here. They're very casually dressed, as you'd expect for Silicon Valley workers. It's a lot of hoodies and jeans and trainers going on here, and everyone's on their phone, perhaps sorting out their email. There's a rather smart-looking double-decker coach. Okay, so this is, it says bus to G-Bus to MTV, and I think this is a Google bus. Yeah, so it's a huge double-decker bus. There's a guy putting his bike on the back. There's quite a lot of people who've got bicycles here. You can put it on a rack or you can put it inside. You're waiting here for a shuttle bus, I think,
yes,
to take you to work. What's the effect of the shuttle bus? Some people are having a bit of a problem with this, I think, in San Francisco.
I really like it. I wouldn't get to work if it weren't for it.
I believe that it decreases traffic.
Because otherwise, how would you get to work?
Yeah, exactly. I don't own a vehicle.
So this is your only route to work?
Exactly.
Yeah. Great to speak to you. Have a really good day
you
at work.
Too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Even cars, it seems, are too old school for these Silicon Valley pioneers. And those shuttle buses have become something of a landmark in San Francisco, as familiar as the cable cars running up and down the city's steep hills. But not everyone likes them. One opponent is Sue Vaughan, a local activist and Green Party member. She thinks the buses are a symbol of Silicon Valley's disengagement from the life of ordinary people in the city.
Tell us about the buses.
The buses are huge. They're bigger than most of our public buses, and they transport people who live here in San Francisco down the peninsula to the Silicon Valley to their jobs. And what has been happening in the last few years is that San Francisco is being transformed into a bedroom community for people who work down there.
And how frequent are the buses in this area? How frequent are the shuttle buses?
At this time of day, they come one after the other. I just took a photograph of three in a row here, okay. One right after the other.
A lot of Silicon Valley companies say that they're making the world a better place, and it sounds to me that you disagree with that.
We think they should be mitigating for their impacts, and they're not. These companies are some of the wealthiest corporations that have ever existed on the planet, and they're having an outsized impact, and they're getting away with it. These companies could be paying for workforce housing. They could be paying for a vastly expanded regional public transportation system. We have got to compel them to mitigate for their impacts. It's got to be the law. It has to be democratic. It can't be philanthropy. I mean, that's not the way to go.
What would you say to people who, if you like, want to resist a similar growth in their own cities, in their own countries? What's their strategy?
Organize, agitate.
Sue Vaughan is putting her faith in the democratic process. She's even taking the city to court. But many in Silicon Valley find democracy slow, cumbersome, bureaucratic, just the way they think of San Francisco's public transport system. Tim Draper, a big Silicon Valley investor, represents many when he says he just wants government to get out of his hair.
I think government hinders us in a lot of ways. They get in the way of some of that job creation. So, for instance, China can do so much more for their citizens and make so much more progress because they are unfettered by the regulatory environment.
We'll be hearing more from Tim Draper in part two of this program. And I'll be looking at what Silicon Valley's values mean for identity around the world. I'll be hearing from people in Spain and Kenya, and also right here in San Francisco itself.
What else has been on the menu today?
We did a pork nacho today with sour cream, salsa. We had a pasta salad. We served cabbage, bread, and fruit.
We serve 900,000 meals a year. And in our lines, we've seen in the past many more homeless, many more people who were truly on the edge, mental ill, but we're still seeing them. But now we're seeing an influx of working class people. People who have jobs are also in our lines because they cannot make ends meet.